Good morning. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR's Central Standard. If you're looking for live coverage this morning of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's statement from the Justice Department, we're carrying that online at kcur.org. Mueller has just announced that he is resigning from the Department of Justice, saying that it's important for his written work to speak for itself. We are monitoring his statement to bring you any major updates, and of course we'll have continuing coverage from NPR News throughout the day. But for now, we are focusing on the tornadoes that hit several communities around Kansas City yesterday evening. So far, there are reports of 15 injuries, three of them serious. Mercifully, no fatalities, but plenty of property damage. KCUR's reporters and partners were out assessing the damage and talking with some of those affected by the tornado, and we've asked them to share with us this morning some of what they have heard and learned. We also want to hear your stories. If you saw the tornado, if you were affected by it, tell us how. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. Where'd you go when you heard the sirens? Did you experience any damage? 816-235-2888. Nomeen Ujiadine of the Kansas News Service is out there in the field this morning. Nomeen, where are you exactly?
I'm in Linwood. It's a town, it's in a rural area, roughly between Lawrence and Overland Park. There's about 400 people who live there, and it saw some pretty extensive property damage from the tornado last night.
Yeah, tell me some of what you're seeing. I think we've seen some of the pictures on the news that some homes were clearly destroyed.
Sure. Well, it actually looks pretty peaceful right now, especially right outside of town. There's not a lot of wind blowing, but once you get in, you can see several houses. A lot of them have had their roofs caved in or blown off. There's a lot of downed power lines, a lot of trees that are down. I saw some downed fences as well. And another thing I noticed was that there was a lot of emergency management and construction vehicles in the area. You could definitely hear the rumble of trucks and the buzzing of chainsaws from people who were trying to clean up after the damage.
I know that you are about to speak with local officials there. What are we expecting to learn today?
Well, I don't know. I'm expecting them to talk about the extent of the damage to the homes in the town, whether there were any injuries, maybe how long it'll take them to recover, how much it might cost the town.
All right. We're looking forward to hearing some of those answers. And I know you've got a press availability happening right now. So I know you're trying to get there. Nomeen Ujiadine of the Kansas News Service, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye.
We're talking this morning about what residents of Linwood, as well as Eudora and also Excelsior Springs over on the Missouri side, may have experienced. We'll have more coverage also, we should say, in the next hour on KCUR's Up to Date, particularly from the Missouri side. But here to help us find out more about what happened in Kansas yesterday is KCUR's Sam Zeff. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning, Brian.
So give us a sense of what the tornado was like. I know that you got in your car and headed west when the first alarms came on yesterday.
Yeah, the tornado first touched down south of Lawrence and then cut a pretty wide swath of destruction, starting at about US 59 south of Lawrence, headed northeast across a lot of empty fields, where as you followed that path, there was any number of trees down, outbuildings destroyed, power lines down. Then it jumped K-10 and hit a little crossroads just outside of Eudora. It's in rural Douglas County. It is part of the city of Eudora, but outside of the town. And there it leveled two homes. I caught up with a farmer, a guy named Josh LaNave, just a few minutes after he emerged from his shelter after the tornado had moved on.
I was sitting on my couch when the warning came in. I went out back, and I could see the tornado coming. So I grabbed the dogs and ran down to the storm cellar. I get down into the storm cellar, and the door to the storm cellar is ripped off, and the two dogs run out into the storm, and then debris just falls onto the cellar doors, which got me trapped in there for a bit. I had to break a bunch of stuff in order to get out. I crawled through a hole about this big. It was tight. And came out and I found the dogs. They were fine. But my chicken coop was flattened. The chickens are mostly fine. I've seen a few of them out running, but I have no idea about my sheep. Where they are is gone. There's nothing left over there by that field.
So, Sam Zeff, obviously a scary situation there, but also one with some economic consequences.
Oh, sure. His house was about half destroyed. He works at a local winery, but farms that land. House has been standing there since 1880. The barn that was flattened had been there since about 1870. But the dogs were fine. The chickens were fine. I've yet to hear about the sheep. Josh was shaken, but physically, he was just fine.
I know you've talked to some other folks, Sam, but we actually have someone on the line who was in that same area south of Lawrence who experienced the tornado last night. I want to talk with Steve. Steve, thanks for calling in.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Did you go ahead?
Oh, I just wanted to say we were south of Lawrence, about 3 miles, and from where what I understand now, the path of the tornado that. We were kind of on the outer edge of it, kind of a rural neighborhood with, 15, 20 houses, each of which had 3 acres.
Steve, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry, you cut out there for a minute. Did you see the storm? Yeah, it looks like we're having some trouble holding the connection with Steve. Maybe we'll get that fixed and we can go back to him later. I know that Steve told our producer that he had some damage and that he actually had to drive into town to use the internet and charge his phone. So that could explain kind of the spotty coverage we're hearing there today, Sam.
Well, power lines were down all over the place. I think residents were expecting that they were going to be without electricity at least for 2 or 3 days. Just as I was leaving that little corner in Eudora last night, utility crews started to show up, but there were power lines not only down, but power poles had been snapped. So it's going to be a while before utilities are back in that part of Douglas County.
I know you spoke with another resident of Eudora who had a somewhat different experience of the storm.
Yeah, so I was walking down the street to go to a damaged home, and I ran into a woman named Becky Platt, who had just grabbed her backpack and on her own came to that little corner of the world that was leveled by the tornado. Let's hear from her.
I was in Lawrence when the tornado hit, and my husband was at home in Eudora, and I headed back home and called him up and said, get the truck out of the garage, and I'm going to grab my jump bag, and we're going to go make sure people are okay in Eudora. There's a lot of trees down. It's kind of impossible for vehicles to get to a lot of these houses and the rural communities, and we have some friends out here outside of town, so we wanted to come out and check on them.
So Becky Platt, as I was walking down the street, I saw her, and we all of a sudden realized we knew each other. It turns out that she is a public education advocate, part of the mainstream coalition, and I would run into her occasionally at the State House when I was covering education. It was quite an out-of-context experience. You heard her say she grabbed her jump bag. She is a nurse by training and knew that she had to get there to help people. Let's hear from her again.
So far, medically speaking, everyone's okay. Fortunately, I haven't had to use any of my medical supplies I brought with me. But we're really having to get to these houses on foot right now because there's trees down, there's metal pipes in the road, there's farm equipment in the road, there's power lines across the roads right now. So you really can't get there by vehicle yet.
And that was Becky Platt. Again, Sam, you spoke with her last night.
Right. So this is about probably an 40 minutes after the tornado passed over Eudora. After that, of course, it jumped the Kansas River and devastated Linwood, which was just to the north of that. Becky wasn't the only medical professional, by the way, who just showed up there. I ran into two guys who were both EMTs, who were no longer working as an EMT, but were trained as such. And they jumped in their pickup truck and went right to those corners because they knew just how bad it was. Luckily, nobody was hurt in that particular part of Douglas County.
We did hear from Douglas County Emergency Management this morning that 15 people have been reported injured, three of them seriously, and we're still waiting for more information on that. Sam, don't go away. We're going to talk now with John Kurtz. He's a meteorologist with the National Weather Service. I want to ask our listeners again, if you experienced the storm, if you witnessed it or are dealing with the aftermath of it this morning, give us a call at 816-235-2888. We want to hear your story. That's 235-2888. John Kurtz joins us from the National Weather Service. John, good morning.
Good morning, Brian.
Thank you so much for being with us. I imagine it's been a busy day for you.
Yeah, it's been a busy day for the office. You know, we've been we got two survey crews out in the field right now. One working on the tornado that went south of Lawrence there and up towards Linwood. Got another crew up there in Clay County as well in the Northland, looking at damage near Kearney and Excelsior Springs.
Yeah, and thanks for mentioning that one. We will have a little more information about that tornado that hit on the Missouri side of the river, the Missouri side of the state line. In the next hour on KCUR's Up to Date. Tell us, what do we know about the tornado that hit Linwood? Do we know its numerical rating and any more information about it?
We don't know much at this time. We're just starting to get a little bit of some images back from the survey crew out in the field. Of course, we've all seen the pictures on television, on social media. We don't have a rating on it yet. It's going to be a long day of surveying. It's a pretty long track tornado with this one. Of course, we're working with our colleagues at the National Weather Service office in Topeka as well, because they actually cover Douglas County and Lawrence. So those two teams have met up and they're talking as well about bridging that gap. But it was a pretty decent, pretty long track tornado that started actually down in Osage County, Kansas. Still not sure on what damage reports we've got out of there, but that's where the warning started last night around 4:39 p.m. And this storm produced that tornado for tornado warnings for almost 2 hours exactly. It was almost 7 p.m. before the storm got to Bonner Springs, Kansas, there just east of Linwood. So this storm, it rode along the warm front, and it just continually produced a tornado for quite a long time yesterday evening.
Yeah, now, I have to say, it appeared, and I'm an amateur, but the tornado was going strong until it got to the more highly populated urban area where it sort of dissipated. Is that something that is related to the population and the development in that area, or was the Kansas City Metro just lucky?
We were just very fortunate here in the metro. Really what happened was, and this happens in the life cycle of a storm that intense, is that as the tornado became what we call rain-wrapped, and you probably saw on TV last night how hard it was to actually see the tornado on the ground because it was wrapped in so much rain, that cooler rainwater coming down actually stabilizes the atmosphere, causes the storm itself to actually what we call cycle. And so as it approached the metro, that tornado became wrapped back up inside the storm and dissipated because it entered that stable air mass. So the storm actually had to recycle itself, and we're very fortunate it took its time over the metro before it redeveloped again there in the Northland up in Clay County. So it really has nothing to do with the metro. We were just very fortunate this go-around that it did not enter the actual more populated areas of the Kansas City metro.
Were the conditions all that unique that set up that tornado yesterday, or is this something that we could see more of in the weeks to come?
Well, we've been stuck in this very active pattern, as many of us are well aware of. You know, the tornadoes are just one disaster on top of a disaster that's been unfolding for several weeks now, which is all the flooding that we've had. And really, what's really driving this pattern of active, very wet weather is the fact that we have a very strong ridge of high pressure over the eastern seaboard, which is causing record high temperatures across parts of the southeast and along the east coast up to New York City. And so that's basically kept us kind of in this kind of blocking us from getting these low pressure centers to kind of move out and get out of the way so that we can get in some dry weather. So for the next week or so, the next 2 weeks, really, you know, we have this continued active pattern until that ridge of high pressure breaks down and goes out over the Atlantic. We could see, we're definitely going to see more rounds of thunderstorms across the metro. Now, yesterday was a little unique in the fact that we had a very defined warm front that was laying east to west across the metro area and across the the plains here. And that really became the focus for where those storms had the most intense updrafts and the most intense rotation. And that storm we had yesterday just anchored itself on that warm front and just made its way along it as the apparent low pressure center moved up to the north and northeast out of Kansas and into Iowa yesterday.
You know, a lot of folks saw pictures, whether they were shared on social media or from TV cameras, of the storm when it was south of Lawrence. And it you could see the clouds coming low and then this very wide, what looked like an enormous base of the tornado. People talked about it being rain-wrapped. Was it an unusually large tornado? What was happening there?
So it can be a little bit deceiving seeing that on TV, just how wide that base of the thunderstorm is. What you're seeing there, the clouds, what we call the mesocyclone, which is the parent circulation of the actual thunderstorm. So the tornado was nestled back in there, kind of obscured by this giant wall cloud. So not all of that was touching the ground as the tornado, per se, but it gives off the impression of a very large and wide tornado. You know, the damage path today, we don't know how wide it is yet. The survey crew will also be doing that as well. So it's not just seeing how strong the winds were, but it's also how wide the actual tornado was. So on TV, it was visually impressive, but a lot of that was just the rain curtains coming down around it and also the parent mesocyclone. What most people have, folks are, you know, kind of weather aware, the wall cloud, if you will, is what you were seeing there.
John, if you could stick with us for a couple of minutes. That's John Kurtz, meteorologist with the National Weather Service. I want to talk to another caller who is calling us from Kansas City, Kansas, near State Avenue, whose name is also John. Hello, John. Thanks for being with us.
Hello. How are you?
Doing great. Did you see the storm yesterday?
Yes, we were on the east side of the speedway on State Avenue, and it did not come over the speedway. It went northeast from where we were. It went up over by Cabela's mm-hmm. and Legends and that nature there. No damage over here that I've seen yet.
You know, I think a lot of people, when we were watching that storm on television, a lot of folks thought it was turning and heading pretty much right to where you are, John. What were you doing to take cover at that point?
I am a truck driver. I had my route is St. Joseph, Missouri, and when I came back to the terminal, my dispatcher told me to park, stop, and get down in the basement of the terminal building. And we could see, it hadn't got there yet, it was probably still about 20 minutes out, but we could see the tornado and the rain, as the gentleman was talking about, you were just talking to, behind the speedway, behind the racetrack.
Sounds like a pretty scary situation to be in.
Not really. Been here for a while, gone through it before, you know. But anyway, yeah, for somebody that's not used to this kind of thing yet, it can be very terrifying, you know.
Yeah.
And I think about not only the people, but the dogs and the cats and the animals, you know, because where are they going to go?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question.
You know, the other comment I wanted to make is I live in Leavenworth, Kansas, and as you probably already know, Leavenworth, Lansing is home to a couple of big prisons up there. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of cleanup required after this devastation. And, you know, I know I used to work in the prison in Lansing, and I know they have inmates that are in there for,
sure,
you know, lighter crimes than the murder and the rape and all this stuff here. Why couldn't some of these people, the emergency management folks, just an idea, get in touch with the prison.
Well,
say, hey, we need some help cleaning up down here.
I hear you, John. I appreciate it, and I think that's something we should probably pass along to prison officials. So, thanks so much for calling. We appreciate your giving us your take on what happened. We're joined now by Quincy Vagel. He is a meteorologist and also a storm chaser, and he was out in the storm yesterday. Quincy, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
You came to our attention when you tweeted yesterday, "The most terrifying storm chase of my life, not for fear of my own life, but for what almost happened to Kansas City." Say more about that.
Well, I've been storm chasing for about 6 years, and I've seen a lot of tornadoes, but lately it's been pretty edgy because we've seen a lot of big cities. Obviously, when a tornado hits any area, it's devastating, but we've had a lot of large cities that have been targeted lately. Oklahoma City last week, we had the Dayton, Ohio tornado, Jefferson City, Missouri, Chicago, Illinois. I mean, the thing with this tornado is that it was rain-wrapped, so even me being a seasoned storm chaser, I couldn't see the tornado, and that was really unnerving because if you had people that were outdoors or trying to look, they wouldn't be able to see it coming.
Where were you in relation to the tornado as it was moving through the area?
I started right down south of Lawrence. I was basically paralleling the storm all the way to Kansas City, so I was probably about 1 or 2 miles south of the storm. So I was relatively close, but like I said, I wasn't able to see it.
And you were able to follow it pretty closely.
Yes, yeah, because I was staying south of the damage path, so that way there weren't any issues, obviously, to the north. What really concerned me, too, for that tweet was I was looking on radar, and you could see that debris was being lofted about 25,000 feet in the air, and that's usually only indicative of the most destructive tornadoes. Mm.
I heard anecdotally that there was damage, that some debris from the Kansas side was found up in the Smithville area after this storm. I don't know if that has been confirmed, but I heard some folks saying that on the news last night.
No, that's true. It sounds like several miles out in advance. That's just how intense the winds were with this storm.
Well, Quincy, where are you off to now?
Well, I'm actually off to North Texas. Looks like there's more tornadoes in the forecast between about Dallas and Fort Worth, Arkansas. So unfortunately, another very active day for severe weather.
Well, sounds like you're on the job. Thanks so much for taking a couple minutes with us this morning.
No problem.
I want to come back to KCUR's Sam Zeff, who is here in the studio. Something our caller, John, said, Sam, was, I said, it sounds like a pretty scary situation. He said, if you lived here a while, these sorts of things happen. We have a certain, maybe overly comfortable relationship with these storms sometimes.
I think it's the storm that you grow up with. You know, when I moved to Philadelphia in the first hurricane I covered, I was terrified because I just didn't understand the nature of hurricanes. I understand the nature of tornadoes, and it is a little less scary. I got to Douglas County yesterday after the tornado had moved through. There were still sheets of rain coming down as I was coming through there. I want to go back to what the National Weather Service said. The path of the tornado, hard for me to judge exactly how wide it was, but I can say that based on the trees I saw down, the street signs on the highway that were toppled, that it appeared to be pretty wide. A mile is probably too big of an estimate, but it was clearly a wide path of destruction as it moved from where he said from Osage County up through Eudora and then on to Linwood.
John Kurtz from the National Weather Service is still with us. John, are you surprised that people can say, oh, we're not too worried about the storms? You guys certainly issue a lot of warnings and a lot of strongly worded messages to the community in these occasions.
Yeah, I mean, there's some of that, and definitely I think it is the fact that we live here in the Midwest. A lot of times, a lot of our phone calls we get and people on social media asking us a lot of questions are folks who are new to the Kansas City area, and it's not. I would never want to say people should ignore warnings, and we try our best not to warn, you know, overwarn for things that are not all that intense. But you know, it had been. Quite a while since like downtown Kansas City had actually been inside of a tornado warning. The last time that it actually happened was May 25th, 2011. Huh. So that's when the actual downtown center was in an actual tornado warning. Of course, Kansas City is a large city limit. So just to give you an idea, like it's very rare that actually occurs.
Yeah.
And so we really want people to take it. Well, from what we can understand, people took action yesterday and definitely went to their shelters and their safe spaces. And we're really fortunate that people did that. And again, and a lot of that is also back to all the work that we do as a group with the emergency management and broadcast meteorologists. We work as a team to make sure we inform the public of what's happening, and we practice for this every year. We're constantly doing drills and exercises with our media members and our emergency management folks to make sure that folks are aware of severe weather and ready for it as well. So I think that's yesterday was a huge testament to that, that the system works and we make sure that we warn folks when really significant weather is knocking at the door.
Yeah, I was struck by, I was at a restaurant in Kansas City. We got all the alerts, but we also have a lot more information than we used to. So people pulled out their phones, they looked at the radar and said, "Nah, it's going north of here," and ordered another glass of wine. Sam Zeff?
The evidence of just how well the National Weather Service and media partners do was evident in my little corner of the tornado last night, where this little enclave, these two houses, both of these folks knew to seek shelter. They went into the basement. When they emerged, there was an enormous amount of damage. But as you heard Becky Platt say, nobody was hurt. And that is completely thanks to the weather alerts that the National Weather Service puts out and then are passed along by TV and radio stations. It was quite a thing to see last night, to see all that destruction and know everybody was okay in that little part of the world.
That's KCUR's Sam Zeff. He was out in the field yesterday covering yesterday's tornadoes. We also have been joined by Jonathan Kurtz from the National Weather Service. John, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Brian. I appreciate it.
We heard earlier from Nomeen Ujiadeen of the Kansas News Service. Thanks to all of you. Thanks, Sam.
Of course, Brian.
We'll have more coverage of the tornado damage throughout the area, including on the Missouri side up near Excelsior Springs, in the next hour on Up to Date. Of course, we'll have continuing coverage throughout the day here on KCUR. Coming up next, something else that brought change to rural Kansas in a more positive way. Trains played a crucial role in the state's history. But now passenger train service in the Sunflower State might be in trouble. We'll talk about the past and the future of the railroads in Kansas when Central Standard returns. Don't go away. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison in for Gina Kaufman. Earlier in this hour, Special Counsel Robert Mueller made a statement at the Department of Justice. He said that he is resigning from the department, said it's important for his written work to speak for itself. He also said that he believes that he does not need to testify before Congress and that he would have nothing to add to his report, that, quote, "the report is my testimony," Mueller said in the statement. You can find out more about that story from NPR News in the newscast at the top of the hour. And of course, we'll have continuing coverage throughout the day here on KCUR. When it comes to the history of Kansas, at least the history of European settlement here, few things are as integral as trains. They created the jobs building tracks, they linked the towns, they physically brought the people west. But today, the future of passenger train service in Kansas is precarious. We will talk about the history in a minute, but first, we're taking a look at the tenuous state of long-distance rail service like Amtrak's Southwest Chief that runs across Kansas in its journey from Chicago to Los Angeles. Corinne Boyer's been covering the story. She's a reporter for High Plains Public Radio and the Kansas News Service. She works from Garden City, and she joins us from there this morning by phone. Corinne, good morning.
Good morning.
So glad you could join us. There's been some drama in Congress about all of this, the train service that crosses Kansas. How come?
Yeah, so last year, the Southwest Chief, or Amtrak, tried to replace part of the passenger rail service from Kansas to Albuquerque with bus services. So that created an issue. And then this year, when Congress designated $50 million to keep that Southwest Chief line going, there was some hesitation from Amtrak to respond to make sure that the Southwest Chief kept running. But they have committed through 2019.
So that's at least a few more months. Why is the Southwest Chief the focus of this conversation? I mean, there are a lot of other long-distance routes in America.
For this, it's because it's important to Kansas and it's important to rural areas in Kansas. It's one of the only ways people in places like Dodge City and Newton can travel from one part of the state to another part of the state or even longer distances. A lot of times places like Dodge City, which have airports, they can be a little expensive for the folks who live there. So the train service is important for them to be able to travel.
And so are they using it to commute, or is this really their connection to the rest of the world for basically every trip they take.
It sounds like it's more of like, it's more of a way to take a vacation, especially in Dodge City. I think a lot of people who take the train from Dodge City all the way out to LA, it's, as the Dodge City assistant city manager told me, it's the only way some of these folks have a way to travel, because they have limited options in a place like Dodge City that's, you know, several hours away from Kansas City or towns with larger airports.
So obviously it's very important to the people who live there. Why wouldn't Amtrak keep routes like this alive?
They're not profitable. So Amtrak wants to expand in more metropolitan areas where they've had an increased demand in ridership, and they want to look to develop lines in areas like Las Vegas that don't have Amtrak services. So it's just, there aren't that many people, according to Amtrak, that ride these routes to make it worth them continuing to invest in rural areas that, like in Kansas, that connect to the Southwest Chiefs.
So in your reporting, when you've talked to these folks, I mean, what's their response to that? I mean, money does talk, right? It's not a nonprofit organization.
Right. So I know that Senator Moran wants a commitment from Amtrak, and he says that, you know, he knows that Amtrak is never going to be profitable along these long distance routes, but it's important for rural communities to be able to have a connection or to be able to have a way to travel.
So Congress is, for now, pouring some money into keeping these routes going, right?
Right. So they approved $50 million back in February. They was part of the it was part of the budget bill that was passed to keep the government running through the through September of 2019. So that $50 million was for long-term maintenance and safety improvements along lines like the Southwest Chiefs.
Mm-hmm. You know, Corinne, I know you work from Garden City. You've spoken with many of these people. It strikes me when I read your reporting that for a lot of folks, this is not just a practical matter of how they're going to get from point A to point B. It seems like there's more emotion in this.
Yeah, I mean, even though these passenger rail lines come through in the middle of the night, I think the one in Newton comes through around 2 in the morning and 3 in the morning. And Newton has one of the highest riderships in the state. I think about 15,000 people rode Amtrak from Newton in 2017. So people, you know, even though these trains come, and I believe in Garden City, they come around 6 in the morning, and then in Dodge is around 5 in the morning. People still get up early in the morning to take them and to ride them both east and west. So,
didn't Amtrak try to replace part of the route with buses at one point?
Yeah, they tried to do that last year. And so
how'd that go?
They tried to do, it didn't go well. So they proposed it, and then there was a letter sent by a couple of senators, Jerry Moran and then Tom Udall of New Mexico and Cory Gardner of Colorado and a couple other senators. And they said that they strongly disapproved of them replacing part of the line with bus services.
I have to say, as someone who has taken a couple of long distance train trips, having to get off the train and ride a bus for a while really does not help the ambiance of the trip.
Right. So they wanted to make sure that they didn't replace any of the service with bus services. And then there was just a meeting last week between the Amtrak CEO and Senator Jerry Moran. And the Amtrak CEO has verbally committed that they'll keep the Southwest Chief Line running through 2020. But the Senator Moran has more questions for the Amtrak CEO, so he's going to follow up and ask Amtrak more questions about their future plans for the Southwest Chief.
Has Amtrak had anything to say about all this to you?
No, they have not. I've reached out a couple of times, and they have not had a comment beyond a letter that they sent a group of senators and press releases. So, no.
So you've mentioned the strong actions that that senators have been trying to take to force Amtrak to reconsider this. What about the cities themselves? Is this something they're willing to invest in?
Yeah, I believe Dodge City has. So Amtrak has done away with a lot of ticket agents. So Dodge City has a couple of full-time Amtrak employees, and they staff that station. And then there were also there was some money that there was some grant money that the city that I believe Garden City and then a couple of cities in New Mexico got, and then Amtrak used Amtrak matched those grants that the city received from the Department of Transportation, and then used the $50 million, $3 million of it, to match those grants to make sure that that the state's funding in these or that these cities' funding was matched.
So, Corinne, what's next? You said that Amtrak has said they'll guarantee the service at least through the end of this year. But what are we waiting for to find out now about the future of passenger rail service in Kansas?
So now they've committed on paper through 2019, through September of 2019. And then Richard Anderson, the Amtrak CEO, has verbally committed to 2020 or to run the Southwest Chief through 2020. But beyond that, they haven't made any commitments. And again, that's just verbally. We haven't seen that in writing, and Amtrak hasn't officially announced that. So I guess it's just a wait and see sort of thing.
That's Corinne Boyer. She's been covering this story for the Kansas News Service. She's a reporter from High Plains Public Radio, works from Garden City, and joined us from there this morning. Corinne, thanks so much.
Great. Thank you.
We do need to take a quick break, but when we return, we'll turn from the future of trains in Kansas to their past. A historian guides us through the rise of the railroads and their crucial place in building the state we know today. Central Standard returns in just a moment. I'm Brian Ellison. Stick around. It's Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. We've been talking about trains in Kansas, and in the last segment, we shared some of why people are upset that Amtrak may be curtailing its passenger rail service. Part of why people care so deeply about trains in Kansas is that they've been part of who the state is for such a long time. We turn now to Virgil Dean, an historian of Kansas, who joins us from the studios of KPR in Lawrence. Virgil, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Brian. Good morning.
It's great to have you again. So we did have trains here in the Kansas area, in Kansas, before we even had a state of Kansas, right?
Yeah, there were a few miles of track in Kansas during the 1850s. Kansas, of course, became a territory in 1854, and the first track was a five-mile stretch from Elwood to Wathena. Then during the war, about 50 miles of track were laid between Wyandotte and Lawrence. Lawrence had train service by the end of 1864, but for the most part, not much happened in that area until right after the Civil War.
Who was riding those trains before the Civil War? Where did they even go?
Well, before the Civil War, I don't think too many people went from Elwood to Wathena.
Right.
But that was just kind of an early effort. People were really excited when the train reached Lawrence. Of course, in the initial train, the Union Pacific, which later becomes the Kansas Pacific, was on the north side of the river. And it didn't get a bridge at Lawrence that could take a train across until 1867.
So when the trains when the railroads are coming out here in the first place, was Kansas the goal, or was it just something they had to get across to get to their goal?
Well, I think it depends on when you're looking at it. In the early period, they were, if possible, they were taking trains during the 1850s and 60s as far as they could go, like across Missouri when Missouri had train service to the Missouri River, and then taking overland transportation to their other destinations during that period. Right after the Civil War, when settlements started to boom, then really most people were headed here. that you think of the Overland Trails as the route that people took to cross Kansas to go elsewhere. The trains, of course, took people all over the country, but a lot of people that were taking the trains in this direction during the 1860s, 70s, and 80s were making their destination Kansas.
And maybe this is obvious, but why were trains seen as more desirable than other forms of transportation, overland routes, for example?
Yeah, well, even though the early trains were pretty crude transportation and weren't particularly safe all the time, they were a much faster way of traveling. You could get across Kansas in less than a 24-hour day, or you might be able to travel 20 miles a day in a wagon train or 30 miles a day, something like that, and or maybe a little faster on horseback. But speed of transportation and ease would be the big draws for that kind of travel.
So what was the impact then of the arrival of the trains on the settlement of the state?
Well, they bring the influx of settlers in large numbers. The trains, of course, are given land grants. We know about the 1869 linking of the nation and the northern, the Indian Pacific and the Central Pacific. That's the one that has attracted a lot of attention. But there were other land grant railroads that were subsidized by the federal government with grants of land. So the railroads had land to sell. And so in addition to the Homestead Act and government purchases of land, you had railroads that were promoting settlement in the state so that they wouldn't be traveling very long through vast open spaces. They wanted people out here. And so during the 1870s, you get the settling up of the central part of Kansas by American and European, Euro-American settlers, some directly from Europe and other places, particularly Europe. Others, the vast majority coming from the eastern states to the east. And then in the 1880s, going on out into the western part.
You know, I have to say, I think of the early years of trains as being primarily about, I don't know, agriculture and industry and the economic impact of them. I don't think of them as passenger rail service. That's something I think about with Amtrak later on.
Right. Well, they play a real important role in both. Obviously, they're, in addition to selling land and giving people rides to get here and to go elsewhere, people are traveling a lot, seemingly. They're also hauling freight, and that's an important part of their service. Kansas becomes, in the late 19th century, of course, a really important agricultural state, and trains are a big part of that, not only so that people can go to these different areas throughout Kansas and settle in towns or on farms, but they're also being able to get materials and to haul the commodities out, buying and selling. And there's also things like the milling industry, which becomes really important in Kansas in the late 19th century, well before the end of the century. And that's, of course, connected to the railroad. So many other things, as well as the railroads employing so many people. So there are many different ways that they have an impact on the state.
Yeah, well, you know, in our last segment, we talked about some of these small towns that are fearful that Amtrak ending its passenger service will have a negative impact on the town, towns like Dodge City and Newton. It occurs to me that some of these towns may not even be towns were it not for the arrival of the trains a century ago.
Oh, that's exactly right. And there were towns that lost out and put their hopes on attracting railroads during this period, even well into the 20th century. Towns were appealing to the railroads, passing bond issues to try to help subsidize a railroad line that would come to their location, because they realized that during this period, if they were going to prosper, even in a small way, they needed that form, that communication with the outside world.
So, do examples of towns like that come to mind that started up with high hopes but just never really made it because they didn't get a train?
I'm drawing a blank on right now on naming a specific one, but there actually are a lot. You have towns like Ness City promoting a railroad early on, that, and of course Ness City survives, but their dream of having their dream of having a railroad to I can't think Oh, it was supposed to be called Pensacola, Nest City, and Puget Sound Railroad.
Oh,
so this was a big plan of railroad development that didn't quite take off.
The Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe rather famously did take off.
Exactly. The first railroad to reach clear across the state is the Union Pacific, which becomes about the time it reaches the Colorado line, the Kansas Pacific, and it reaches there in 1869-1870. The Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe was a little bit behind, but it reached the Colorado line by the end of 1872. And, of course, both of those railroads would play a big part. We think more of the Santa Fe, but because of the impact it has on settlement in central Kansas and freight and passenger travel. But the Union Pacific, of course, is early tied to the cattle industry at Abilene and that kind of thing.
Is there a point you can identify where the railroads really started to diminish in importance to Kansas?
Yeah, I think that as far as freight, well, probably freight and passenger, really keeps going strong through the Second World War. And it's in the 1950s, and in particular, I think most people would probably agree with the development of the interstate highway system, that you have a real hit to the railroads in a lot of different areas, particularly probably passenger traffic. Mm-hmm. But it even starts to go down in terms of expansion of the railroads to smaller communities in the 20s and the 30s when people become more and more inclined to turn to their automobile for both passenger and, you know, pleasure transportation, traveling back and forth to towns and reaching out and hauling freight and so forth.
I've read that the Southwest Chief, which is Amtrak's current service that crosses Kansas, is the successor to something called the Super Chief, a train that started in 1937 and sort mm-hmm. of had this this celebrity mystique.
Yeah, I haven't thought about that for a while, but that Southwest.
It went from Chicago to L.A. to Hollywood.
Yeah, and I think that's the one that's tied in with some of the Harvey Girl stuff and all of that kind of thing. So that's another part of the story too that's interesting.
I'm curious. I mean, in that era and in the sort of the way train service evolved through the years, especially as it affected passengers, was there a point at which Kansas felt more like a destination and less like a, I don't know what we would, in the airplane world, we would call flyover territory?
Well, I suppose just like with the trails, with the exception of that time when people were settling up the state. And that really goes from the end of the Civil War, particularly in the 1870s and 80s, into the 20th century. But by the first decade of the century, the number of farms has reached its kind of peak, and starts to consolidate somewhat. The state's population experiences its major growth by the end of the 19th century. After that, there's steady growth for quite a long time. But that's when people are coming. After that, it's probably more traveling various places. And whether it's across the state or just going from Newton or Dodge City or Garden City to Kansas City or Denver, that kind of travel would be the case. Would be important. So I think probably for most people throughout the country, it's not going to be too much different than the interstate highway system, mm-hmm. which takes people across in much of the 20th and, of course, into the 21st century.
And you very rarely stray very far from the interstate itself.
Yeah, so you didn't stray too far from the trains unless you had another destination off onto one of the secondary routes.
You know, I know you're an historian and not a nostalgia artist, but I mean, how important, Virgil, do you think it is that passenger rail service might be ending in Kansas? What would be lost if the service was replaced with buses, as Amtrak is at least considering?
Yeah, I heard when I heard that last year, I thought, well, that's quite not like I think you said in the earlier segment. That's not quite the same experience that you're or the kind of experience you're looking for if you're traveling cross country on the train. I don't know. I think it's like anything that you lose. It's an important part of the community and the state's history. And we've had passenger service that was vital for a century. It's fallen off in recent years, but it'd be a loss to a lot of people for practical as well as nostalgic purposes.
That's Virgil Dean. He's an historian of the state of Kansas and all of its history, and talking with us today about the history of trains in the state. Virgil, thanks so much for spending time with us.
Very welcome, Brian.
He joined us from KPR in Lawrence. That's all we have for today. You can catch any of this morning's conversations, including our earlier conversation about the aftermath of yesterday's tornadoes, at kcur.org/centralstandard. Don't forget, you can even subscribe to the show as a podcast. That, too, at kcur.org/centralstandard. Join us tomorrow for a show about why access to healthy food is an environmental issue. We'll have that conversation tomorrow at 10. The show is produced by Melody Rowell, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and Salisa Kalakal, plus our new intern, Riley Kester. Welcome, Riley. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is coming up next. Stay with us.